Jedi Outpost, Endor. 12 weeks after the death of Mara Jade Skywalker.
My brother died in the Yuuzhan Vong War. Not Anakin. Jason. It's taken me years to work that out, but I should have seen it from the start. Jason, the brother I loved, my twin, never came home. It just looked as if he did. I think the core of Jason probably died in the embrace of pain at the hands of Verger and the Yuuzhan Vong. Whatever came back was another person, a total stranger. It's the only explanation for what he's become. So that's why I've reached the point of doing something utterly unthinkable. Because the unthinkable is the last card we have left to play. The only way I can stop Jason and his war from swallowing the whole galaxy. It was the Mandalorian crush guns that made up my mind. As Jag had proven, they certainly work. They're nasty weapons. Mandalorian iron, Beskar, is pretty well nearly lightsaber proof. I almost expected the things to detonate when Dad opened the package. Since when did Boba Fett ever send my father gifts? Since his daughter was tortured to death by my brother, actually. We've been waiting for Fett's revenge ever since, but so far, nothing. Just the gift of crush gauntlets and armor plate, all made from Mandalorian iron. So I'm packing for a journey I didn't think I'd ever make. I'll give Jag this much. He never said I told you so. He's the one who said I needed to learn from someone who had a track record in bringing down Jedi. If anyone can stop Jason, then it's me. I'm his equal, and I'm the sword of the Jedi, but I just don't have his training. I have a chance, and Fett's going to help me make the most of it. It can't be that hard to find him. He's a bounty hunter, so I'll hire him, like any other client. Except I'm not just any other client. I'm Han Solo's daughter, and I'm a Jedi. And Fett has spent a lifetime hunting us. And now I'm asking him to train me, to hunt and capture my own brother. For all I know, he'll laugh in my face, if he ever laughs, that is, and tell me to get lost. But I have to ask him. Swallow pride, eat humble pie, and beg if need be. Dad seems to have thawed a little toward him. I still despise him. But if he says yes, I swear I'll be the best pupil he's ever had. Come on, Fett. Show me how it's done.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Revelation. By Karen Travis. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
Jedi Outpost, Endor. 12 weeks after the death of Mara Jade Skywalker.
Ben Skywalker had thought it would be a simple matter of thumbing his lightsaber into life, screaming vengeance or choked into silent grief, he didn't care which, and slicing Jason Solo's head from his body. He sat flicking the blade on and off, staring down the shaft of blue energy and watching it vanish, only to snap back into vivid life over and over again. He saw his mother, who couldn't be summoned back again at the flick of a switch, although he would have given the rest of his life for one more chance to tell her how much he loved her. But the image that he wanted to erase yet couldn't was Jason Solo's face.
I had the chance to kill him. Dad stopped me. Maybe I could have killed Jason without turning dark. Will I ever get another chance?
Jedi had killed Sith before, but nobody thought it was an instant passport to the dark side. Some dirty jobs had to be done. Ben had thought his absolute, all-consuming need to destroy Jason had passed. But it hadn't, and neither had his grief. It had simply shifted position. It ebbed and flowed, some days worse than others. He would not get over it. Now he was ready to pour his heart out to Leia. He waited. Eventually, he heard two sets of footsteps coming down the passage and had a sinking feeling that Luke might have met Leia in passing and decided to tag along. But when the doors opened, it was Leia and Jaina. "Ben," Leia always had that calming tone that said everything was under control, even when it wasn't. "What's wrong?"
"I've got some difficult things to say," he said. "You might not thank me, but I can't sit on it any longer."
"You know you can tell me anything," Leia said. "Do you want Jaina to leave us alone?"
No, as long as you don't rush off and tell Dad, because he thinks I'm over the Jason thing now, and I don't want to start him worrying again."
Jaina sat down next to Ben.
"It's okay. I won't say a word, and Mom's the diplomat. What's so bad that you can't tell Uncle Luke?"
"I don't think Alimarar killed my mother," Ben said. "I still think Jason did."
Leia just stood there, arms folded, but she didn't react. Jaina shifted a fraction on the seat. He waited in the agonizing silence.
"What makes you think that?"
Leia asked at last.
"I'm not going to rely on what I feel," Ben said, "even though I feel it. I'm going by things that don't add up. You know what police look for? Captain Shivu taught me. Motive means opportunity. And family doesn't seem to mean much to Jason. Look at the things he's done to you and Uncle Han."
"I know Jason's done some terrible things, but let's go through this a step at a time," Leia said. "You've accused him before, but we're all pretty messed up lately. Why is this still eating at you?"
"The way he found me on Cavan."
"He's good at finding people in the Force, Ben."
"I was hiding, doing my shutdown act, and he still walked straight up to me in a tunnel on a deserted planet that's the back end of Beyond. And then there was the Sith meditation sphere that Lumaya had."
"What about the sphere?" said Jaina.
"I found it on Zyost. I handed it over to Jason when I docked it in the Anakin Solo. Next time I see it, Lumaya's driving."
Leia sucked in a little breath.
"Okay, file all that under unexplained. How about motive?"
"How about the fact that Mara was in his way?"
said Jaina sourly.
"No, let's hear Ben's view."
Ben was theorizing now.
"I spent a lot of time telling Mom about all the things Jason was asking me to do in the guard, and I could see it made her mad. I'm sure she bawled him out."
"Okay, so that's motive, maybe. Now let's look at means.
Only a really skilled Jedi could ever take down Mom. Look at all the stuff Jason can do."
"But poison? That's Alima's trademark."
"So it's obvious to use it to draw suspicion elsewhere, isn't it?"
"Sweetheart, Alima had the sphere. She was in league with Lumaya, we know that. And I'm sure Captain Shivu would confirm that people stick with one method of killing that they feel confident using. Alima spent the last year trying to kill as many of us as she could."
Ben was off and running down the behavioral path now.
"Okay, Alima was crazy, but she didn't have a motive for killing Mom. It was always about you and Uncle Han."
He shook his head.
"I don't buy it. Because she'd have bragged about it to Jag if she'd done it. She'd have wanted us to know she got in one good shot, to hurt us all, to hurt you. And then there's opportunity. She was in the area, yes, but we also know for sure that Jason was in the Hapen system around the time it happened."
Leia looked as if she was taking it seriously.
"Well, it doesn't clear him," she said at last. "But it's not exactly enough to take to a judge, is it? He could have been in the Hapen system planning to kidnap Alana."
Ben strove for a rational tone.
"Aunt Leia, why do you think Mom hung on in corporeal form for so long? Why do you think her body disappeared just as Jason showed up at her funeral? Don't you think the Force might be saying something to us? I can't stop thinking about it. I've turned it over and over in my head for weeks. I daren't discuss it with Dad, but it's driving me crazy."
Leia took a few steps forward and squatted in front of him to put her hands on his knees.
"Ben, you said you recorded everything you could at the scene."
"Yeah, because nobody can mind rub that or tell me that I imagined it."
"Have you found anything in the recordings?"
"Not yet."
"Okay.
I'm going to find out exactly what happened, Aunt Leia. I have to. And I'm going to do it by the book, because I need to be certain, or I won't be able to live with it."
Bastion, Imperial Remnant, Admiral Pelion's residence.
Galad Pelion, still healthy in his 90s and with no intention of fading into senility,
was playing Theed quoits on the lawn when his aide entered the walled garden at a brisk walk. The Admiral didn't take his eyes off the target, a short pole shaped like the flower spike of a Setheth water lily, one of a dozen set in the shallow ornamental pond. But he could see all the signs of urgency in his peripheral vision.
Yes, Vitor?
A military attaché from the Galactic Alliance is here to see you. Vitor Rej had saved Palian's life in the Yuuzhan Vong War, and now he defended him from all other equally irksome visitors. Shall I send him away?
Remind him he should make an appointment if he wants an audience, not drop by to solicit me like some door-to-door tradesperson.
I think he might have been anticipating that. He handed me this note.
Open it for me,
Palian said.
If you think it might raise my blood pressure, throw it in the bin. If not, it can wait until I finish my game.
Theed quoits was a pursuit that taught patience and concentration, as well as providing gentle exercise.
Well, is it going to give me an aneurysm, or just provoke spluttering rage?
I really think you should read the message, sir, if only for amazement value. Vitor held out the unfolded flimsy with a bemused smile, and Palian took it. You'll be annoyed, I think. It was handwritten, or at least fashioned to look like it, and it was an invitation after all, but not quite the one that he was expecting. The Joint Chiefs of State of the Galactic Alliance respectfully request a meeting to discuss a mutual aid treaty with the Imperial Remnant, and the addition of its assets to the GA fleet in exchange for substantial benefits. A translucent green official seal was stamped across Jason's signature. No sign that Admiral Nyathol had seen this then. A Mon Cal should have known better than to back a little despot like Solo, so perhaps she wasn't involved. But then Nyathol had her own agenda, and it almost certainly didn't include Jason as a valued co-worker for life.
The brat.
Palian had resigned rather than be forced to work with him.
No, I was forced out, and I haven't forgotten that,
Palian thought.
No, Jason, you cannot play with my ships,
he snorted.
Nor can you buy them.
He crumpled the flimsy in his hand, feeling the fragile seal crack, and tossed it back to Vitor.
I can see no merit in aligning the Empire with a regime that has no current bearing on our interests.
I'll return this to the attaché as it is, then, shall I, sir? Said Vitor, tilting his head slightly to consider it. I think it's quite eloquent.
A gesture is worth 1,000 words, but 2 often suffice.
Chief of State's Suite, Senate Building, Coruscant. 2 days after the return of the Anakin Solo.
Darth Kydus stared at the crumpled note in the tray and wondered what Palian thought of him. It didn't matter, but he was curious. Perhaps I didn't explain myself clearly enough, he said. What do you think, Tahiri? She examined the note and shrugged. I think you're talking to the wrong person, Tahiri said. It's the Moff's backing you need, not Palian's. He's the last person who'd help you. Tahiri, to get the Moffs to back me, I need to be endorsed by Palian, Kydus said. It's more than his position as Bastion's head of state. I can bypass figureheads when I need to, but the old boy is still very much hands-on, and he has enormous sway over the Moffs. They would commit their forces to the GA for the right reward, but not as long as Palian opposes it.
And does he oppose it? I can see why he wouldn't exactly trust you.
No, I'm not his favorite person, and I suspect he regards Nyathol as a traitor in that stiff upper lip way of his. But this isn't a refusal, I think. Just a gesture. I believe he wants to be wooed. Tahiri's mind was calculating visibly.
So, what's the right incentive for the Moff who has everything?
More of it, Tahiri. More. Everybody likes more.
But more of what, exactly?
Territory. I was thinking of Bilbringi, or Borleas, actually. Maybe both, if I have to. Shipyards and banking. I think the Moffs will like that, if I can get Palian to see sense.
He's a pragmatist, she said, and he wants the best for his little empire.
He likes his honor better. Kydus smiled and reached for the pile of datapads. There were a couple of items that troubled him still sitting in view. But I think he needs time to consider this, and perhaps a visit from someone persuasive, preferably in a smart suit and shoes, Tahiri. She gave him a withering glance.
You want me to see him?
I hope you'll do better in this task than the last.
I've done my best, Jason.
Yet you can't find the Jedi base.
And obviously neither can you.
Show me you can complete a mission. Talk to Palian. Kytus picked up the first datapad on the pile. Intelligence reports confirmed that Corellia had placed an order for the Mandalorian's Bezulik fighter. It was faster than an X-Wing, armored in virtually impregnable Mandalorian iron, Beskar, and for sale to anyone who had the credits. Off you go, Tahiri. Come back to me with your timetable and strategy for getting an audience with Admiral Palian and signing him up to the cause. Kytus would have to do something about the Bezulik. The simplest option was to buy a squadron for the GA, even if that rankled. But if Fett could play the longer game, so could he. The fighter was a joint project with the Verpine of Roche, part of a cozy mutual aid treaty between Kaldabe and the Verpine Hives. Kytus put the Verpine down on his list of beings to educate later. He would also steer clear of Mondalore for the time being. He had more urgent issues in front of him. Fondor was still a major irritant, churning out warships for the Confederation at its orbital yards. It was a continuing threat, and it lay close to rich mineral resources in an asteroid belt. It built star destroyers. Assets like that couldn't be allowed to remain in enemy hands. So he would deal with Fondor as his next priority. He picked up his comlink and keyed in the code for his closest and most irritating colleague, Admiral Cha Nyathol, Joint Chief of State of the GA. Admiral, he said cheerfully, we really have to do something about Fondor.
Pralsine, near Kaldabe, Mandalore.
The weathered helmet of Fenn Shaisa still stood on a granite column in the clearing, firmly secured by a durasteel peg. Only animals or storms would have dislodged it. Nobody would have thought of stealing the relic of a much-loved Mandalore. It had even survived the Yuuzhan Vong's attempt to devastate the planet. Shaisa was revered.
Been a long time, Shaisa.
Boba Fett didn't make a habit of talking to dead men, except his father. It was the first time he'd visited the site.
You got your way.
The helmet had once been vivid green with a red T-section, but the paint had dulled to browner tones, and the scrapes and dents of battle were more visible. The memorial was a substitute for a proper Mandalore's grave. Shaisa's body was still in the Quen sector, where Fett had left it. The helmet was all he'd brought back. It was an apt memorial for a populist leader, to be commemorated in the same way as any ordinary Mandalorian. Only the Mandalore, the head of state of a stateless people, was buried. Their nomadic warrior culture had no tradition of orderly cemeteries.
Where will they bury me? If I have any say in it, when the end really comes, I'll just set Slave One on autopilot for the Outer Rim and keep going.
Fett had been an absentee Mandalore, ignorant of his own people's traditions. His lessons, whether he wanted them or not, came from his newfound granddaughter, Myrta, who insisted on calling him Babuir, grandfather, and encouraging him to embrace his heritage. Relations between the two of them were tepid. That was a big improvement. They started out as homicidal.
I can't wait for you any longer.
The sudden voice in his helmet's audio link made him jump, but it was just Myrta. She was itching to get underway for Vaida.
You'll wait. You've waited 3 months. You can wait 10 minutes more.
Fett tapped two fingers on his helmet in a farewell salute to Shaisa and swung back onto the speeder bike. Fett set off for Goron Bevine's farm, skimming above the silver ribbon of a tributary that flowed into the Kalita River. Myrta was a persistent girl.
Babu Weir, you want me to start the drives?
No.
Are you okay?
Is Goron there? Has he got the room ready?
Of course he has. Goron's never let you down.
It was true. Is Belloween's accommodation sorted out?
Yes, but...
Then someone better tell him the ore you bought is as 5-star as we get in Kaldabe.
You're psychic, Babu Weir.
Fett wasn't.
but he knew his personal physician well enough to predict that he wouldn't think a room in the rustic Oyubat Tapcalf good enough for a fancy Coruscant doctor.
Tough. I'm the customer.
When Fett banked the speeder around the last stand of trees, he could see Myrta leaning against the aft hull plates of Slave One, arms folded across her chest, and Goron Bevin waiting beside her in his slate-gray farm overalls.
No good acting like you don't care,
Bevin said, as Fett opened the cargo hatch from the remote on his forearm plate and steered the speeder onto the ramp.
You might have left her, but she's still your wife.
Fett secured the speeder.
Ex-wife.
The rooms and med droids are ready anyway.
Fett didn't mean to sound ungrateful. Bevin was a good man. Fett's chosen successor if anything went wrong. Like death, like illness, like just plain old age. And he'd put up with a lot of demands since they'd located Sintus Vell's body. Fett's wife wasn't dead. Dead would have been hard after she'd been missing for more than 30 years. Dead would have been easier than finding her encased in carbonite, stored like junk among some dead gangster's forgotten possessions, and then working out what he'd say to her.
How do I tell her our daughter Aelin's dead? How do I tell her everything that's happened since she went missing? She's got a granddaughter.
Fett released the hatch, and Myrta climbed into the cockpit, a battered bag over one shoulder. She was in her mid-20s, although she had a scrubbed look that made her look like a kid, and that meant she wouldn't be that much younger than her grandmother when she was revived.
But you don't know that. Sintus could have been captive for years, and only carbonated recently. She could be nearer my age. She was a few years older than me.
Either way, it was going to be a very hard reunion. The last time he saw her, he'd left her injured in an alley. It was an ignominious exit to add to abandoning her and their baby daughter. And now all the pain was going to come erupting to the surface again. All the memories he'd locked in his past as surely as carbonating them, so he never had to look at them.
The medroids got full psychiatric programming too, Bobica, Bevin said quietly.
People usually came out of carbonite in a bad way. Anything from blind and disoriented to totally and permanently insane. She'd really thank him for that, if he only knew what her chances were.
Thanks, Goron. Tell Madrid I'm grateful.
Oh, we've always got room for guests. Keep our jar. It's nothing.
Okay. Look after the shop while I'm gone.
Fett settled into the pilot's seat and waited until he saw Bevin walk clear of the downdraft before he flicked the controls, and Slave One throbbed into life. The North Mandalorian countryside receded below into a patchwork, and the sky through the viewport darkened to violet and then black as they left the atmosphere. There was no going back now.
What if she ends up insane? Asked Myrta.
Han Solo was carbonited, and he's been strutting around just fine.
Fett set course for Faida, manually just to keep his hands busy, to stop thinking, and to avoid a conversation with Myrta. He even kept his helmet on in the cabin, his hint to her these days that he didn't want to talk.
Where did you go this morning? She asked.
Fett paused.
Shysa's memorial.
Why?
Here we go. Hadn't been there since he died.
Your brother said you deposed him.
Brother? Brother. Jang. Jang Skirata. That stinging smile of the clone who was still around all these years later. He's not my brother. We just share a genome, more or less. And I told him he didn't know what went on between me and Shysa.
But you came back, and Shysa didn't.
Long story.
Got plenty of time. What happened?
It gave Fett the occasional twinge of regret.
I killed him. I killed Finn Shysa.
Fleet Headquarters, Galactic City.
Admiral Cha Nyathol could sense the mood of a ship or shore establishment the moment she stepped on board, and the mood of this one was shocked fear. It was impossible to keep some things quiet, and killing a junior officer on the bridge of the Anakin Solo was about as hard to hide as it got.
It can't be true,
but the Anakin Solo's captain, Krall Neville, a Quarren with a solid reputation both as a pilot and a commander, had witnessed it. He wasn't the only one who'd seen the incident. It wasn't just buzz, the fast-flowing river of gossip that circulated through both wardroom and lower deck throughout the fleet. Colonel Jason Solo, Joint Chief of State of the Galactic Alliance, had snapped Lieutenant Tabut's neck without even touching her, on the bridge of his flagship, in full view of the crew. The reason didn't matter. The enormity of the act made any reason irrelevant.
"He's lost it. He's become a megalomaniac. What do I do now?"
Nyathal strode along the corridors of the HQ building toward the wardroom and then walked into her office. Captain Neville was waiting for her. She closed the doors and swept the room for bugs with her hand scanner. But even when it came up clean, she still whispered.
"All I can hope,"
she said, not waiting for him to speak,
"is that when news spreads, the crews believe it as much as I did, or think that the poor woman deserved it for some reason. Because if they do reach the conclusion that he's a monster, morale will collapse and we've lost."
Neville didn't respond. The Quarren usually kept his counsel, but he seemed to be even more tight-lipped today.
"What is it, Captain? I've swept for surveillance devices. You can speak freely."
His mouth tentacles rippled, as if he was measuring his words carefully.
"What are you going to do about Solo?"
"For the moment, there's very little I can do,"
she said.
"Ma'am, you can put me on a charge for saying this if you like, but he needs to be relieved of duty."
"Do you trust me, Captain?"
Neville's tentacles became still. He was wary now.
"I think I still do."
"Then if I say that I'm as appalled by this monstrous act as you are, but that I have to make sure I'm actually in a position to do something conclusive, will you accept that without further explanation?"
"I believe I get the general meaning, Admiral,"
said Neville. Nyathal wasn't sure he had.
"When you fire on a target like Jason Solo, you daren't miss or just wound him. You have to make sure he can't return fire. Ever."
Nyathal needed to broker a discreet meeting with Luke Skywalker. But first, she had to be true to form and confront Jason Solo indignantly about his latest lapse of judgment. She summoned her chauffeur. Jason was in his office, watching an intelligence holovid, a recording of a fleet engagement. "What have I done this time?" he said, not looking away from the screen. I could feel the little black cloud of reprimand coming.
"Stay angry,"
Nyathal thought.
"Don't let him sense anything beyond that."
Nyathal took a deep breath, disguised as an exasperated human sigh.
"Jason, I know you're very new to the military, but here's a tip to help you fit into the culture of the wardroom. We don't kill junior officers on the bridge in front of everyone. It's bad form. At least try to do it somewhere less public in the future."
He looked up that time. "Ah, word gets around." She didn't sit down. She couldn't stay angry sitting down.
"Word gets around the fleet, and fast. You're a fool."
"Really? I thought I was doing quite well."
"Morale, Jason. It's an asset. Every bit as much as a Star Destroyer. We ask those we command to be ready to die for us, not because of us. And the moment we lose their confidence, we start to lose the war. We need them."
"Oh, and they need me. The pact works both ways." Tabut was careless. "It's not an exercise, Admiral. It's a real war, and mistakes get you killed. I think we'll see an improvement in security procedures after this."
"Good. I'll spend some of my very limited time repairing the damage you've done to morale, then. Because if a ship's company is terrified of getting something wrong, pretty soon they stop using their initiative and don't do anything at all. Do I need to explain?"
"You care too much about being popular."
"Yes. I must keep my party girl image in check."
"Anyway, Fondor, time to pick them off."
"I would prefer to hit their industrial capacity first. Shut down their shipyards."
We need those assets in one piece.
If we want them as a going concern, then we'll probably have to occupy the planet to enforce that, because the government isn't about to capitulate, and we don't have the resources to do it.
We might.
Oh, do share!
The Imperial Remnant. I'm opening negotiations.
How good of you to involve me in this!
I haven't committed us to anything.
If you think Palian is going to kiss and make up after I took his job, you're really not paying attention.
Well, just to give the Moffs an incentive to persuade him to forgive and forget, I was thinking of offering them some extra turf in return for joining us. Borleas and Bilbringi. When we defeat the Confederation, we'll shape the galaxy as we see fit for the greatest benefit. They contribute to that, and they get two rich worlds for their trouble.
Galactic City Spaceport, Coruscant.
It was a planet of a trillion people, and Ben knew Coruscant well enough now to vanish within it. He shut himself down in the forest long before the flight from Bespin landed in Galactic City, more out of fear of implicating the people he intended to contact than worrying that Jason would sense him and come after him. At Galactic City Spaceport, the transport disgorged its long-haul passengers, and Ben slipped through the merging streams of bodies from all parts of the galaxy, a single fish and a multicolored shoal. As in most apartment buildings in the capital, an array of crime prevention cams kept watch on the entrance. Ben visualized the sensors getting a sudden burst of intense light, using the Force to overload them for a moment to give him time to pass into the turbolift. All the monitoring system would see was a short period of dark shapes as the cam tried to compensate for the light levels its sensor told it were there. At the 400th floor, Ben slipped out into the corridor and stood outside Lan Shivu's door for a moment, trying to sense if anyone was inside. It felt empty. Ben tried the pass card and it didn't work. It took him a couple of seconds to force wipe the lock to its default setting and slip inside. He'd stayed here before when Shivu had given him a bolt hole so he wouldn't have to go home and face Luke. Ben settled down facing the door. He occupied his time by reading his datapad and speculating. 4 hours later, four senses on edge, he felt a familiar presence and rehearsed all the different ways he could start telling Shivu that Jason was now out of control. Do I mention Mom first, or do I work up to that? He decided to play it by ear. Footsteps paused outside the doors. The silence went on longer than Ben would have expected for Shivu to find his pass card, and then the doors parted, and Ben realized what a bad idea it was to surprise a trained cop. The whir of a charging blaster made him leap up just as Shivu burst through the gap and fired. Ben deflected the bolt, sending a stack of holozine pads smoking to the floor.
Sir, it's me! It's Ben! Hold fire!
Shivu, panting and wide-eyed, was down on one knee by the cover of an armchair with his service blaster still leveled at Ben.
Stang, Ben! Don't do that! Call ahead, for goodness sake.
Sorry. Sorry about the damage, too.
Shivu stepped back into the corridor and said something to a person Ben couldn't see. The neighbors had stuck their heads out of their doorways to see what the noise was about, and Ben heard a few words like, "Thought I had a burglar, but it's a buddy," before Shivu shut the doors behind him and stood looking down at Ben.
"You're in trouble."
"No, Jason is."
"Oh, that's okay then." Shivu flashed his eyebrows. "We're all in the poodoo. We've been told you're not GAG personnel any longer. Jason didn't say why you left, but when he suggested that we tell him if we ever saw you, I reached my own conclusions. It's kind of hard to ignore the mayhem going on with the Jedi Council."
Shivu checked himself, as if he'd just made a terrible gaffe. "Oh, what kind of buddy am I? I'm sorry about your mother, Ben. I really am. That was thoughtless of me."
Ben took a breath and dived straight in. The cue was there.
"It was Jason who killed her."
"Yeah, you're right."
Shivu wasn't even mildly surprised.
"You knew?"
"Come on, Ben. You know the rules of evidence as well as I do. I've got nothing solid. It's got his fingerprints all over it, though. Not that Jedi leave any, of course.
He'd be the first suspect whose collar I'd feel, believe me. What's your theory on your mother?
Jason was in the right place. He had the means to do it, and I think his motive was that she found out he was a Sith. I don't have any evidence linking him to the scene, except he found me with her body, and he shouldn't have been able to. The only thing I can pin down is location.
Crime scene's compromised now, I suppose.
I recorded it.
Good man. We'll make a CSF detective of you yet.
I need your help, sir.
Drop the sir. It's long, Shivu said. I'll help you. This is a murder investigation. I'll stay on the inside as long as I possibly can. Shivu looked resigned. And he likes to have me around, even on the Anakin Solo.
Admiral's private launch, en route for Enzoth.
Nyathol was never convinced that Jason wouldn't change the locks when she turned her back on him, but she refused to be tainted with the culture of paranoia that she could see developing in the civil service and among senators. Even so, she broke her journey to Enzoth and switched vessels 2, 3, 4 times, on the pretext of inspections across a number of ships, from auxiliaries to troop carriers, then left in her private launch alone, without a pilot. There was healthy unparanoia, and then there was just asking for trouble. And she had to see Luke Skywalker. She took up position at the rendezvous point, 15,000 kilometers off Enzoth, checking her scanners for vessels, and wondering if it was always going to be this way.
Admiral Nyathol, permission to come aboard.
Master Skywalker, you almost gave me a cardiac arrest.
Stealth X, no point taking chances.
She waited until the docking light showed green, and then opened the aft hatch to the tiny cargo bay. The top canopy of the Stealth X was wedged into a vacuum-tight docking skirt that made it look as if it had rammed the launch from the rear at a 90-degree angle, canopy first. Luke dropped out of the fighter's open cockpit and landed on his feet.
I braked too hard,
she said. Remind me to ask Incom to fit a docking tube. Luke grasped her hand as if he was grateful to see her. Sorry, I just don't take chances these days.
None of us do. Thank you for seeing me.
This is mutual, Admiral. I'll have a favor to ask of you, too.
I'll be brief, then. If you haven't already heard, Jason has taken to killing members of his wardroom in full view of others, using force methods.
Luke shut his eyes for a moment.
I know he's fairly cavalier about killing, but I suspect I was right in assuming this would mark some threshold for you, too.
It does.
Depending on how you look at it, then, it could lead to some advantage, and poor Lieutenant Taboot's life won't have been spent in vain. Jason may lose the loyalty of his troops, or it could simply consolidate a reign of fear.
Luke rubbed one hand across his face, brow to chin. I think I recall how that morale-boosting technique played out in my father's generation.
Well, I still have a duty to the Alliance and my personnel, and I'm still prepared to pass intelligence to you, provided you can use it to remove him. I don't care what you do with him, restraint jacket therapy at some quiet monastic retreat, or shove him out the nearest airlock, but I want him gone.
I have Jedi working hard to seize him, Admiral. Do you think he's insane?
No. I've seen too many perfectly sane beings become utterly corrupted by power. Jason's not insane. He's just had his own way once too often, and now he can't see the world any other way.
Do you know what I mean by a Sith?
I've heard the term, but I know nothing about them.
They're Force users who prefer the dark side, like Palpatine.
Oh, I see. Fallen Jedi.
Luke pressed his lips into a little humorless smile and looked away for a moment. Oddly, that's just what the Mandalorians call them. Their word means ex-Jedi, although that's not always the case.
And does this make any difference to how we approach him? Does he have different powers from regular Jedi?
Not really. He's just very strong. And he has an ability to use a battle meditation technique that gives him a remarkable awareness of the battlefield.
He has a young woman called Tahiri Vela running his errands now.
Which brings me to Ben. Luke moved closer to Niathal and looked into her face, which required some head-tilting on Luke's part because of the set of Amon Kal's eyes. Apologies, Admiral. We're all scared of our shadows these days. I might be putting a man's life at risk, so I have to be certain. Ben has gone off again, and I believe he's back on Coruscant. He thinks I don't know, but he's probably trying to build a case against Jason for killing Mara. Niathal almost sighed with relief.
If I see him, I'll make sure he gets every assistance to stay out of harm's way, especially if he goes after Jason to take revenge.
He's already tried that, after Jason tortured him.
Just when I thought the man couldn't get any worse.
He might be with Captain Shivu. They were close.
You trust Shivu?
Yes. There's such a thing as force certainty, and I have it in that young man.
A GAG insider would be helpful to us all.
Faida, Imperial Sector. Treasury Repositories, Darafa.
The slab of carbonite lay on a trestle draped in synthetic gray velvet weave, looking for all the world like a funeral byre. Fed inhaled the musty air and held out his chip from the Registry of Testaments and Legacies, his authorization to collect the belongings of a dead scumbag called Rizodar. The lawyer's minion took it, checked it, and stood back to let Fett and Myrta cross the threshold of the storeroom. Fett didn't know Rizodar and didn't care. He could guess the gangster's lifestyle. This was Faida, after all. On a bad day, it made Nar Shada look classy.
"I'll leave you to clear the store, sir," said the minion. 3 hours maximum. Everything must go. A droid is available if you need help loading."
There was only one thing Fett wanted. The rest, he'd jettison it, even give it to the deserving poor, or, given that this was Faida, the undeserving criminal classes.
"They'll be all."
He took a few steps forward.
"What order do you want to do this in?" Myrta asked.
She'd been quiet since he'd dropped his bombshell on her about Shaisa. She stood on the opposite side of the shrouded carbonite slab and took off her helmet.
"Let's check the carbonite first."
He took the top edge of the velvet weave. The drape of the fabric clung to the little mountains and valleys of a face, a once familiar land. Then he drew back the sheet, and it felt like the moment he saw Aelin's battered face when Myrta opened the body bag. The shock of the face of a stranger he ought to have known, but whose life he had missed almost completely.
"Oh!"
said Myrta. It took a lot to shut the girl up, but it was the second time Fett had heard that choked-off gasp today. Even in the monochrome contours of the carbonite shell, Sintis was recognizable. Worse, she was beautiful.
"Get the repulsor lifts."
He clamped a unit on each edge of the slab and glanced around the room. There were crates of varying sizes, sealed and dusty. He had no choice but to take them and go through them in detail later, in case they shed any light on Sintis's fate. Myrta checked the boxes and began attaching repulsors to them. She walked the boxes out across the landing area and steered them up Slave One's cargo ramp with a practiced hand, then jogged back and moved the next crate. Fett stayed with Sintis's slab, unable to leave her alone in this miserable place.
"You ready?"
Myrta asked. "I'd ask if you were okay, but I'd never get an answer."
"I'm okay. Are you?"
"No. I'm scared. I don't know how to tell her about Mama. I don't know how I'll handle it if she ends up crazy and would have been better off dead anyway. But I'll deal with it."
"I'll tell her."
"Give me some warning. How did you two part the last time you met?"
"I shot her. And it was for her own good."
"Yeah. Somehow, I didn't think it would be a moonlit walk along a shore on Naboo and a tearful promise to stay friends."
"It was to stop her opening a booby trap."
Fett flicked the controls on the repulsors and eased the carbonite slab off the trestle, aiming it at the exit doors. Myrta stepped to one side to avoid it.
"Just a small blaster burn. She would have been fine in a few hours. She always healed fast."
"You didn't wait to find out?"
"She wasn't dead when I left her."
"Well, she did better than Shaisa then."
He should never have mentioned Shaisa.
Shaisa was a mercy killing.
Myrta turned her back on him, displaying a saffron plate decorated with gold sigils and glyphs that he'd seen on the Vavut clan's armor. She was definitely serious about Ges Orade, then. That meant Fett would have a grandson-in-law soon, and with it, kinship to Novik Vavut and the rest of the clan. It was all getting too much for him. Too involved. Too rooted. Fett craved loneliness right then. Yes, loneliness. It was a much simpler emotion to handle. "You sound as if you're straining out a confession a word at a time, Babuir," she said. "So either spit it out, or let's concentrate on worrying about... Babuir." Grandmother and grandfather were the same word in Mandoa.
"I didn't want to do it. I didn't even want to be Mandalore. But if I hadn't shot Shaisa, he'd have died a rotten death. I owed him better than that."
Slave One touched down at Bevin's farm in Keldabe at dusk. A small, grim-faced welcoming committee met the ship, and Fett could only feel discomfort that he had an audience to observe yet again what a shabby job he'd made of being a husband and father. Dr. Belluin was there, as commanded, incongruous in his soft city clothes, his white blonde hair whipped by the breeze. Bevin and his partner, Madrid Fasur, looked at the carbonite slab with matching frowns. It was rare to see Bevin wearing anything but a cheerful grin. Madrid raised an eyebrow.
"I'm no expert, of course, but that was a handsome woman you had there, Fett."
Fett noted the past tense and the implication of his ingratitude for the lucky hand he'd been dealt, and followed the slab into Madrid's workshop. Madrid had cleaned up one of the side rooms in the workshop for the carbonite removal process. It was where he recharged blaster power packs with Tabana gas. Belluin looked horrified as the slab was lowered into the release vat.
"It's okay," Madrid said. "I've thawed plenty of this stuff. It's how we used to ship Nerf carcasses when I worked on Olinet."
"How very reassuring."
Belluin opened his bag to take out a tray of pneumatic dispensers and vials of medication.
"I must write a paper on that for the Galactic Journal of Endocrinology."
Now the onlookers had thinned out to just Fett, Myrta, Belluin, Medrit, and Bevin. Medrit stood with his hand on the controls.
"Say the word, Mandalore."
"As soon as she's free of the carbonite, I need to get her heart rate and blood oxygen up right away to minimize tissue damage," said Belluin.
He held a hypo spray as if it were a miniature blaster, and in his other hand, he had an oxygen delivery device like an aquata breather.
"Stand clear."
"Ready, Doc?"
Medrit asked.
"Ready."
Medrit pressed the switches, and the ferrocrete vat erupted with cold vapor and loud hisses as gas escaped. Fett thought it was noisier than he remembered, and then he realized it wasn't the escaping byproducts of the thaw, but the weak, panting squeals of a woman in agony. Belluin dived forward, blocking his path, and reached into the miniature storm that had formed above the vat.
"It's okay, Babuir. It's okay, it's okay."
Myrta leaned in too, taking the spent hypro from Belluin's hand while he applied the breather. Sintis wasn't screaming. She'd never been a weakling, not her. But the sounds she was making were incoherent, the panic of any terrified animal with something unfamiliar pressed to its mouth by a stranger.
"You're safe. It's okay. You're going to be all right."
When the vapor dissipated, Myrta held Sintis's hand while Belluin slapped a monitor on her arm. Sintis was thrashing about, trying to sit up, and staring, totally uncoordinated, eyes rolling. She pulled her arm away from Belluin, grabbing blindly for anything. Myrta caught her arm.
"You're among friends. Easy. Udesi. Just relax. Let the doctor take a look at you."
Sintis looked right through Fett, her face all white terror made more stark by the ink-black Kifar tattoos, the Kukuf. She was blind.
"Well, she can move,"
Belluin said.
"No paralysis. Excellent."
Myrta and Bevin lifted Sintis and laid her on a repulsor trolley, wrapping her in blankets. She was calming down now, or at least exhausting herself into a quieter state. Fett dared to step closer. Bevin put a discreet hand on his back to steady him.
"Madam,"
Belluin said,
"can you hear me?"
He checked the device on her arm.
"Can you tell me your name?"
She jerked her head in the direction of the doctor's voice.
I don't know. don't know... Who are you? Where's... Oh, Stang, I don't know who...
Sintus had been frozen in her mid-30s. She was a shuddering wreck coming out of the agony of carbonite suspension, but she was still a beautiful woman.
Let's get her to her room. Dr. Bellouin needs to carry out his examination.
Amnesia's really common in carbonite cases, Bevin said kindly, following the repulsor into the main body of the house. But how much of the past would you want her to forget for good?
It's not her who needs to forget. It's me.
Bastion, Imperial Remnant. Moff Assembly Hall at Ravelin.
It was always sobering to be a spectator at your own funeral. Palian stood at the window, overlooking the parade ground, and watched the ornate cannon carriage that would carry his remains. The paired blood fins drawing it came to a halt at precisely the center of the paved expanse. Blood fins were notoriously hard to train in the art of precise cavalry displays. Palian made a mental note to congratulate the ceremonial staff. The carnivorous quadrupeds were formidable mounts, quite capable of fighting on their own, even when their rider was dead, and they were not known for their obedience off the battlefield. Bastion had to rehearse the state funeral regularly, because such magnificent displays of pomp and precision didn't happen overnight. A leader might die at any time, and Bastion liked to be prepared. Palian sipped his calf, aware of the hum of conversation at his back, and watched the carriage and the guard platoon vanish into Ravlin's early morning quiet.
"Doesn't that depress you, sir?" asked Vitor.
"Only if I'm taking part."
Palian held out the translucent cup for a refill.
"I'll worry when I see hundreds of guards in the parade best."
He watched the reflection of the room behind him and the transpiristeel sheet of the window, and noted each moff's arrival and whom he huddled with to chat before the meeting started.
2 minutes, Vitor, and we begin.
It was a regular weekly assembly of the Moff Council of the Empire. All those moffs, and so very little empire to play in. It was bound to make them restless. Palian glanced around the table during the meeting, playing the game of working out which of the moffs wanted to assassinate him, and which saw some advantage in keeping him alive. Luckily, the only ones who were competent to take him on were also the most militarily able, and so were his allies. Nature had her checks and balances.
"Admiral, something significant has come to our attention," Grand Moff Quill said. "I wonder if we might discuss it in the wider context of the war."
"The Empire has managed to stay out of the conflict so far," said Palian. "What do you mean by context?"
"Threats and opportunities, Admiral. The war is sucking in more worlds, and the Jedi Council has upped sticks and moved out of Coruscant, which is a worrying development. It suggests more fragmentation in existing alliances, and that might make our neighboring sectors unstable. But it might also give us an opportunity to expand our sphere of influence."
Palian took a spoonful of Gen honey and held it above his cup, letting a long ribbon of viscous amber run off the spoon into the calf, then twirled it with a practiced wrist while he waited for Quill to continue.
"Do go on," said Lesserson, one of the old-school moffs.
"Our diplomatic sources say that the GA is recruiting allies from outside its usual sphere of influence," said Quill. "When the war is over, the map of the galaxy will look very different."
Lesserson smiled.
"Well, there's a big gap near Corellia where Centerpoint used to be, for a start."
There was a ripple of laughter. Quill pressed on.
"Rewards may be there for the taking, gentlemen."
"In exchange for fighting Jason Solo's war for him," said Rosette. "Is there anything we want badly enough for that?"
The discussion began rambling over the possibilities in a tapestry of voices.
"Nihal's war, too."
"Oh, let's not forget the Admiral, shall we? If an Admiral was running it, it would be over by now."
"Solo could always lose the war, of course."
"If the GA is thinking this way, then perhaps the Confederation is too, and maybe they've got a better offer."
"Is there an offer?"
The silence was sudden. It was an excellent question.
"Bill Bringy and Borlaeus, if we commit troops and ships to the GA.
Palian let the names sink in.
And of course my question would be, what's in it for us? Both those worlds are in the GA's gift to give, but there's still a small population in both systems, and we still might have to fight to take them. If it's the latter, then all the GA is doing is turning a blind eye to any expansion on our part in exchange for our blood. And that seems to me like paying twice. If we want to expand, Solo would be in no position to stop us anyway while he's so thinly stretched in this war. And we would need to commit nothing to his land grab expeditions.
Then the question is whether we want to expand the Empire, Lesserson said. Do we?
I would be inclined to wait and see what's left of the galaxy before we decide what we want, said Rosette. It might be the difference between snapping up a bargain at a sale and taking on a charity case that saps our resources.
Palian felt the surge of old emotions again. This was about duty.
We are the Empire,
Palian thought.
We bring about order and justice for the common good. My problem with Solo,
Palian said carefully,
is that he has no background in government or the military. Jedi are very good at being in opposition, being the conscience on the shoulder of leaders and keeping them on their toes, or even playing peacekeeping shock troops when needed. But they do not run things well. They're doers, not managers.
Solo seems to be winning rather a lot for a man whose first uniform was a colonel's, Quill said.
There's a Mon Cal admiral in a shiny white suit to whom he owes at least some of that, I suspect,
Palian said. Are we taking a vote on this? Asked Rosette.
There's no formal offer and so no motion on the table.
Lesserson drew the questions away from Palian. I would simply suggest that we keep a watching brief on the situation, and if an opportunity arises to clarify what Chief of State Solo has in mind, then we look to Admiral Palian to explore it if he so wishes. The Admiral has unique experience in seeing history repeat itself.
Anakin Solo, Gandiol Fondor Hyperlane.
No, she's gone. It was the second time that morning that Darth Kydus had turned to Lieutenant Tabut for a sit-rep and remembered she was dead, which left him unsettled for reasons he had to stop and ponder. Captain Shivu gave him an odd glance when he turned to the station that Tabut had normally occupied on the bridge, but said nothing. Kydus wandered across to the viewscreen to look out at distorted time and space, a respite while he grappled with his lapses. Tahiri, playing the part of a junior officer perfectly, stayed at her station with her hands clasped behind her back.
Dropping out of hyperspace in 5 standard minutes, sir, said the officer of the watch.
Very good. Kydus tore his gaze from the transperisteel and strode back to his bridge position. So, Tahiri, we'll see Fondor shortly. She was in blue uniform, no badges of rank, and proper Black Fleet issue boots, the ones with durasteel hardened toe caps for safety. This is the next dissident planet we take back.
Not today, though, she said. We're doing reconnaissance.
A recce wasn't needed, given the intelligence Kydus had on Fondor. Less than a standard year earlier, it had been a Galactic Alliance member state, and so its defensive capability and industrial output were a matter of record. Worlds didn't change into unknown quantities that fast. But Kydus was still baffled by Fondor's decision to secede from the GA, an act he saw as inexplicably treacherous. No, said Kydus. We're showing Fondor how easy it is to get at them. A speeder bus ride, practically.
Don't they know that?
We often ignore the obvious. And this is partly education for you. Tahiri's eyes flickered a little.
In which discipline?
Decision-making. The task of sweet-talking Palian into listening to Kydus's offer was something any intelligent, personable woman could do. But Kydus needed Tahiri to be more than that.
Okay,
she said. Her lips moved uncertainly.
I mean, very good, sir.
Kytus watched the viewport as the slightly misshapen disk of Fondor resolved into a sharp-edged planet, ringed by orbital shipyards like a swarm of tiny moons. Take us in as close as you can, Helm.
Very good, sir.
The Star Destroyer moved from open space into the invisible but fiercely defended borders of Fondor sovereign territory. By now, the early warning beacons had picked up the Anakin Solo's approach, and the ship's long-range sensors showed that Fondorian fighters were scrambling. Soon there would be a concerted attack on the ship, and he was counting on that. He wanted to test Tahiri's nerve and commitment.
"Weapons, officer," he said. "When you acquire a target, do not fire. I repeat, do not fire. Shields and defensive systems offline."
Nobody said a word, except Tahiri.
"Is this some special tactic? A feint?"
"No. I'm leaving the ship wide open to attack."
"But..."
"The weapons officer will give you firing solutions. You don't have to do any calculations. You only have to decide whether or not to open fire."
"That's easy enough,"
she said, not sounding convinced.
"If someone's working out the firing solutions."
"Are the fighters a threat to us, Tahiri?" She was having doubts now. He'd sown uncertainty in her mind simply by asking an apparently obvious question.
"Possibly."
"How will you know?"
"When they power up their weapons."
"We have weapons online. Are we a threat to them, or just ready to deal with an attack? What are your rules of engagement? What if they don't fire?" To her credit, Tahiri seemed to be thinking logically. The fighters were closing in. Bridge crew began shifting in their seats now, a little uneasy.
"Quickly, Tahiri, you only have seconds. A second is all it takes for a missile to penetrate the hull, vent a whole compartment, kill hundreds of our comrades."
Kytus knew the Fondorian pilots would detect charged, targeted, locked-on cannon and yet no defenses. They'd think it was a trap. They'd hesitate, assess the target, wonder what they'd missed.
"They've powered up but not acquired us, sir," said the weapons officer.
"Tahiri?"
"Fire,"
she said.
"Take, take, take!"
Cannon fire stabbed into the flight of fighters, streams of it taking out all six of them in sudden silent blooms of white light.
"Reactivate defenses and lay in a course for Coruscant," said Kytus.
The Star Destroyer came alive with the lights and sounds of preparation for the hyperspace jump back to the core. Tahiri was still staring at the viewport.
"Now, was that the right decision?"
"You tell me," he said.
"I neutralized the threat."
"Or you fired on vessels that hadn't targeted you and made widows and orphans for no good reason. Which do you think you did?"
"It's a war."
"Wars have rules."
"You told me to fire."
"I told you that you could fire." Kytus could see the crew trying to pretend the dissection wasn't taking place in front of them. "The decision was yours."
"Is that what this is all for? You brought the ship here just for a few minutes to see if I could give a command to fire?"
"Yes."
"And put the ship at risk? And kill pilots?"
"It's what we do. How do you feel about that? Do you think about the living beings in those fighters? Or do you think about us in this ship? And can you ever be sure you took the only reasonable path open to you?" "I can't answer that." "To become my apprentice, you have to be able to answer that in your own mind and live with the answer. You killed today. It should never feel easy or distant like some Holovid game. If it does, or it doesn't trouble you later at some time, then you're not up to the responsibility." Tahiri stood silent and wide-eyed. She looked as if she was seriously considering the implications. Kytus retired to his day cabin and sat reading the previous day's intelligence reports on the journey home. There was a bleep at the cabin door. Shivu. Kytus felt the man coming down the passage, heralded by a sense of wariness and distaste in the Force. Shivu was a former police officer, a Coruscant Security Force man, and he brought his culture with him. He didn't like Kytus, and he didn't approve of his methods. That was as clear as day. But Kytus trusted him precisely because it was clear, even to a non-Force sensitive. A man who didn't try to hide his feelings, but did the job well anyway, gave Kytus nothing to fear.
"Sir, shall I leave these reports on your desk, or would you prefer to discuss them?" Shivu said.
"Leave them." Whether the man liked him or not, there was nothing to be gained by alienating him further.
He was very good at his job. You look tired. Sleepless night, sir. Shiva was being brutally honest. Problems? Family stuff, sir. I'm sorry. Isn't it time you had a few days off? I need you sharp. Take 72 hours and come back refreshed. Shivu's surprise was palpable. Thank you, sir. His mood felt as if it had lifted a little. Most generous. Kaidus watched the doors close behind him, and he was reassured that he hadn't turned into a monster, whatever Ben Skywalker might have thought. Different situations required different incentives, and Shivu couldn't be scared into compliance, or it would have been no good at an intelligence-based dangerous job. He couldn't be cajoled for the same reasons. He had to be treated with honest respect. The man was as straight as a die. There were few like that, and worth the keeping.
Keldabe, Mandalore.
Jaina dropped out of hyperspace in the X-Wing and hoped that making herself slow and obvious would prevent a misunderstanding about her intentions in a Galactic Alliance fighter.
Keldabe ATC, this is X-Wing Amber 9, requesting permission to enter Mandalorian airspace.
She checked again that every weapon system was powered down, so that nothing, absolutely nothing, gave them the wrong impression about her intentions. The X-Wing held its position.
Keldabe, this is Amber 9. Are you receiving me?
Keldabe ATC to 9 Amber,
said a female voice that didn't sound remotely ruffled by the intrusion of a GA fighter.
Parasol, wait one.
Would they even recognize her? The X-Wing was obvious enough, but she wasn't a known face like Jason or Mom. She was just a pilot, not even in GA orange, deliberately low-key in a somber flight suit with her hair tied back. Jaina had never been in Mandalorian space before. Mom had, in her rebel youth. Jaina waited, cultivating a patience she never knew she had. Her force senses told her something was approaching, but she sensed no danger. Nothing showed up on the X-Wing's monitors other than a medium-sized ship with a heavy drive, something like a spaceport tug or some utility vessel. It was very close now. Jaina still couldn't see anything, but it was approaching from her port side. Then the lights came on. The brilliant blue-white light seared her eyes for a split second, but when she blinked away the afterimage, she was looking at a grim slab of a vessel that was a mass of cannon turrets, turntables, hatches, and angles. There was no other way to describe it. It was a flying tank.
Keldabe welcomes careful Erutise, if their credit's good,
said ATC over the comlink.
9 Amber, what's the purpose of your visit?
I've come to see Boba Fett.
Amber 9, identify yourself.
Keldabe, I'm not GA anymore. I've come alone.
Follow your escort.
The tank rotated 90 degrees in the horizontal and pulled away in front of her, dipping its starboard side like a wing to indicate her to follow. Before she reached the upper atmosphere of Mandalore, the ungainly-looking tank was joined by a smooth, delta-shaped fighter. It was the Bezulik she'd seen on the holonews channels. The vessel maneuvered between her and the tank, so close that she could see the helmeted pilot turn to give her a hand signal, familiar to any pilot. Follow me. The tank peeled off and vanished, showing remarkably little heat signature on Jaina's sensors.
What was that? She asked.
You want to place an advance order?
Said a male voice. It was the Bezulik pilot.
Mondal Modus calls it a Trakard, the Star Saber.
Landing on Mandalore needed every scrap of her attention. She was suddenly in a busy airspace over heavily wooded country scattered with small villages. Keldabe loomed in her viewscreen, a massive, disorganized fortress set on a granite pedestal ringed by a moat-like river. She could identify the Mandal Motors Tower from the logo painted on it, that grim animal skull with a flare emerging from one empty eye socket. She brought the X-Wing down in a smooth descent, tailed by the Bezulik. Jaina shut down the systems and prepped to pop the hatch.
Get down from the cockpit, Arueti. We'll check you out.
Now, do I take my lightsaber or not? Jaina thought.
Jaina took the risk and left it in her grab bag in the cockpit. She jumped down and stood on the permacrete. The air smelled of fresh-sawn resin trees and hot metal.
Just tell me what Arueti means.
Foreigner, said the pilot. He pulled a short-stock Blastech blaster from his belt with a casual movement and ran a hand scanner over her with the other.
Outsider, not one of us. Okay, you're clean.
What happens to me now?
Someone's coming to check you out. Can't let just any old riffraff pest our Mandalore, can we?
Absolutely, she said. The Bezulik pilot didn't say anything else to her, and just stood with his blaster resting in the safety position against his shoulder. They waited. Eventually, a speeder bike headed straight for her.
She's all yours, said the pilot, unarmed.
The rider was a man in royal blue armor, and she sensed that he was agitated, but in a distracted way that said he was worrying about something else.
I'm Goron Bevine, he said, looking wary.
A short but serious-looking metal saber hung from his belt, as well as a blaster.
The Mandalore's tied up at the moment, so you can tell me all about it. Get on.
It was tempting to just come clean and tell him she was Jaina Solo. Yes, that Jaina Solo. But a black object dangling from his shoulder plate distracted her. It was alien hair, somehow familiar. Mandalorians love their trophies. Fett went in for braided Wookiee scalps.
Is that Yuuzhan Vong? She asked, trying to be casual.
Indeed it is, said Bevine. Nothing I like better than killing crab boys.
That was the sum of their conversation, until they reached Keldabe. Bevine stopped the speeder in front of what could only be a cantina. Its doors parted, and the smell of cooking and brewing wafting onto the street. Above the entrance was lettering Jaina couldn't read, and helpfully, a few words of basic. Universe Tapcalf. No strills inside. Barter accepted. Jaina followed Bevine inside. He took off his helmet, laid it on the counter, and ruined another stereotype for her. He wasn't some granite-faced thug, but an ordinary gray-haired man about her mother's age, with the kind of face that looked on the edge of a big smile all the time. When her eyes adjusted to the light, she found herself in a cantina full of armored Mandalorians, not all human, helmets stacked under tables. They were watching a big holovid screen in intent, reverent silence, mesmerized by a bolo ball match.
Meshgaroya,
Bevine whispered, as if he was interrupting an act of worship.
The beautiful game, or other national pastime.
The place smelled of spice, yeast, and fried food, and most of the patrons were drinking a black ale or small glasses of a clear liquid that almost certainly wasn't water. Her four senses told her they were all much, much more worried about the final score than they were about having a stranger among them.
I'm sorry to stare, Bevine said mildly, but I know you, and I'm trying to think where I've seen your picture. Never mind, it'll come to me.
Fett knows me and my family, she said. He'll know why I've come.
The bola ball provided a neutral distraction. She was almost caught up in it, so deafened as the room turned from total silence to explosive yells of
Oya!
When the favored team scored, that the sensation that ran up her spine and made her hair bristle caught her by surprise.
Impossible, Jaina thought. No, that's just not possible.
What's wrong? Bevine asked. You think that go was offside?
Jaina whipped around, ready to run, and the doors opened. Something was wrong, very wrong. The Force was telling her something that couldn't be true. Two Mandalorians walked in, one in armor with no two plates the same color, and one in green, clearly much older, and walking as if his joints were painful. The older man eased off his helmet and placed it on the counter. Yes, he was old. He looked as if life had drained him dry.
Hello, Jedi, he said, and drew a blaster.
En route for the Hapes Cluster.
You sure this isn't a trap?
Ben asked. I told you Jason was nuts. Shivu was heading for the Prolemian trade route in a small transport bearing the livery of the Geological Survey Team of the University of Coruscant. Ben felt confident about pulling off this ruse if they were questioned, because they really did look like a student and an earnest young lecturer in some arcane study of igneous rock. Ben certainly wanted to look very closely at Kavan. but he had no way of knowing that I was going to do this before he told me to take a break.
He had some other motive, though.
Well, he didn't know we'd go to Cavan, and he won't know we've been.
Ben went back to his datapad, understanding how tense Shivu was. He could have told Tenel Ka what they were doing, but that would have meant official Hapen security involvement, and Shivu didn't trust anybody. Ben saw his point. He'd trusted Jason, after all. Now he was back in the land of hard evidence, running through all the data he'd gathered in a stunned haze while his mother lay dead in the tunnel on Cavan. She was, of course, in most of the Holovid recordings. Ben had watched those over and over until he could look past his mother's body and the pain of reliving the discovery. He saw instead the position of the body, the surrounding area, what material was dislodged or broken, the unoxidized bright color of the smashed bricks that told him the damage was new. He reconstructed a savage fight, so much destruction of the tunnel complex on the abandoned world that force use was obvious. There were no traces of detonite, the only other explanation for that much damage. Ben checked the profiles of the air samples he'd taken. There was the trace of high-energy vaporization from lightsabers and a lot of trace elements released by smashed brick, wood, and stone. What could he have missed? The Hapen Deep Space security sensors picked up the university transport as soon as it came within range, and the only thing that seemed to concern the control center was whether the survey was looking for gemstones. They seemed touchy about that. Shivu put on a very convincing, droning voice, explaining that gemstones weren't anywhere near as interesting as the Carlanian volcanic pipes and surrounding igneous rocks that would shed more light on the latest theory about the origins and formation of the Hapes cluster. He was reading off a datapad. It did the trick. The control center stopped him midway through a riveting explanation of the outcropping of cylindrical diatremes and gave them clearance to land on Cavan